Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and as you know, we are continuing our conversations. We will be doing so for some time to come about what Trayvon Martin's death means for America, what the conversation is that we need to keep having with one another about what this means. We're now about to talk with Matthew Cimarron Gomes, who is a Master of Letters in Renaissance and an Early Modern Studies student in the Center for Early Modern Studies at the University of Aberdeen. That's a mouthful. And wrote a blog post titled An Open Letter to Whites About the Black Community and the Trayvon Martin Case. And Matthew, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hello.
Matthew, I was really taken by the piece that you wrote because what you're throwing out here is just how important it is for us to keep looking at the Trayvon Martin case, look at Trayvon Martin as a human being, and realizing how deep the wound of race still is in this world. Matthew?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. A lot of what I was trying to get at with the piece was that so much of what lies behind the personal racism that was operative at the level of the human encounter between George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin is the failure to imagine the other complexly, if I can borrow a phrase from John Green, an author I'm rather fond of. It's the inability to see the humanity of the other, and that other is masked from us by the structures of systemic racism and structural human inequity that puts up these walls between us and doesn't allow us to see each other really and truly.
I mean, one of the things, though, you see that I think a lot of things came out of this, and I think that I don't know how it starts a conversation or if it will start a conversation about the continuation of racism and race, but I think that one of the things you're talking about here is to say, white people in America, you have to stop and listen to what's going on. Because people don't. When you talk about in your piece, and I'm glad you talked about Rachel Gentil in your piece because of the sense in America that white people look at black folks if you are anywhere, and if you don't speak the King's English the way people think you should speak it, then you're not taken seriously, nor are your words taken seriously, nor was she taken seriously or respected.
Yes, what I meant there is one of the aspects of privilege that I think really does not get enough discussion is that the burden of proving oneself is placed disproportionately on those who are not privileged. And I don't simply mean blacks when I talk about that. Every single person, whenever it's relevant in any context that you are not a white, straight, cisgendered man, you must prove yourself. The real normative, the everyday standard of the human person is the white, cisgendered Western man. And when you speak out about being something other than that, about speaking to your experience, you have to prove yourself in this incredibly unjust manner. So much more weight is placed upon, in this case, in black people, to speak well, to dress well, to present ourselves in accordance with these expectations that are not placed upon other groups. The same happens when women speak about the experiences of sexism. The same thing happens when queer persons speak about the experiences of homophobia. That much more is asked of us than is asked of the person who is making these demands.
So let's ask you this question. I'm just curious. You're an American?
No, I'm Canadian.
You're Canadian. Okay, so you're Canadian, and because you didn't sound like a Brit, that's why I was curious. Since you're studying, and so how is the experience of being black and Canadian different than being black and American, or is it?
The experience of being black and Canadian is going to be as particular as the experience of being black and from anywhere else. Canada has its own peculiar histories and its own peculiar context. Canada does have a history of slavery, but it is farther back in our past slightly than it is in the American context. But it also simply does not weigh as heavily upon the consciousness of Canadians as it does upon the consciousness of Americans. So it doesn't loom over us when we're thinking about race. To be black in Canada also doesn't come with a lot of the same implications. I think black Canadians don't always deal with all the same associations of criminality. In Canada, we don't have the same kinds of large inner city black ghettos because there have simply never been as many blacks in Canada, either flat out or in terms of proportion of the population, as there are in the United States. there are not all of the same structural associations, and there are many more unique histories. The vast majority of Blacks living in Canada are not descended from slaves that lived in Canada. The vast majority of people in Canada, all people of color, are people like me, whose ancestors, often our parents and grandparents, came to Canada from majority Black countries relatively recently. My own father was an immigrant from Antigua and Barbuda. I cannot speak to a lot of the experience of being Black in the United States, but I can speak, I think, to the experience of being othered. And that's very much an experience that doesn't know borders.
I mean, especially when you write, and let me just read a piece of what you've written here on your part called Sight. You say, I've long described to white friends the process of dressing or otherwise self-presenting to white myself, the way I dress in an academic setting, the way I speak and write, the extracurricular activities I put on my resume as a teenager, all carefully considered to avoid any shred of Blackness. Why? Because Blacks with the gall to be Black, to act and speak as if you deem Black, are really deemed worthy of your respect. In this world you have created, for me, my Blackness is a handicap I must not acknowledge, a lodestone around my neck I dare not draw attention to, because then I will be an activist, the angry Black guy who does know that MLK fixed the system.
That section, that was actually one of the hardest sections for me to write, because in my own life, the experience of whiting myself has been one of the most burdensome realities of my life as a person of color. Because in my youth, like a lot of Black teenagers, I liked rap. I enjoyed a lot of aspects of prototypical Black culture. And there was a time when I even started dressing in a way that reflected that culture. I had an afro. I wore a pickinette. I wore baggy jeans, and people didn't respect me. All of a sudden, I was so much more a threat, so much more an outsider, and I just didn't understand why. And when I started working, I started getting the most direct questions about my race. And I realized that it was because I wasn't playing along. I wasn't pretending that Blackness isn't a thing. I was enjoying and celebrating my Blackness, perhaps not in a way I would do so anymore, but that's what I understood it to be at the time. I was trying to understand what it means to be a Black person living in Canada today. I was trying to present and participate in Black culture, and it hurt me. The people around me were afraid of me. They did not trust me. I would get asked incredibly personal questions in professional or formal contexts that I've not since been asked since I stopped dressing in a manner that's more quote-unquote Black. And this is something I've dealt with a lot of my life. I've had very direct questions from academic superiors. I can tell you there's a one-to-one relationship between the interviewers who have asked me about the color of my skin and the jobs I did not get after an interview. So it's something that I think a lot of us have to learn, that every time we go out the door, we have to be ready to present ourselves to the world, and that involves more for us than it does for other people, because the color of our skin comes with a lot of baggage in the eyes of others, and the burden is placed upon us to remove that baggage, not upon the people who don't suffer that kind of baggage.
So, and even through all you've been through growing up in Canada, and I think you wrote this piece. This one line, this piece, I think, let's just go back to this piece here for a moment, and because there's so many things you said here that are so, that you could feel the kind of angst you were going through, kind of put this on paper after what happened. And when you write to people, in this letter to white people, saying that that there are talking heads and pundits out there saying Trayvon's choice of clothing was a factor in his death. Some cried victim blaming, an apologism. Others cried prudence. Black voices intoned both. Whoever is right, Trayvon Martin's clothing was not protective. Instead, it painted a target on his back and hung around his neck a sign that read threat. Right or not, this ruling has reminded me why I prefer to let the rain fall unhindered on my head. That's a very sad, profound, and scary statement.
It is, and I can honestly say that I wasn't simply being poetic when I wrote that, because I have had the personal experience of putting a hoodie on my head in the rain and observing that the people around me were afraid. On more than one occasion, simply waiting for the bus in the dark at night, people have been afraid of me, and I've taken the hood off and let myself get wet, because I don't want people to be afraid. None of us want the people around us to be afraid of us. We want to be seen as equals. We want to be respected. And this leads to what Reni Eddo-Lodge, who is a Black feminist activist here in the United Kingdom, has referred to very poignantly as the politics of proving yourself, which she's also pointed out very accurately has more to do with internalized racism than it does with anything else, that we have internalized this idea that we are threatening. And so we are living and accepting the notion that we should be self-presenting to not be threatening. We have accepted the burden of our Blackness, and it's not a burden that we've created. It's been given to us. And so it's often prudent to simply accept that burden. There's no particular reason why, waiting for the bus, I should go on a diatribe at the tall white woman who's afraid of me about why that's racial profiling. It simply does make more sense for me to take off my hood and get wet. But I shouldn't have to, and that's a lot of what I was trying to speak to here, is about the burdens that are placed on us, and yes, about the Black voices who do accept these burdens, even when we don't need to. It's not our responsibility.
No, we only have about 2 minutes left in this segment, Matthew. Literally 2 minutes. How have your fellow students at University of Aberdeen in Scotland accepted what you've written?
The majority of the readers of this post have actually been in the United States, and it hasn't been as popular here in the United Kingdom. The Trayvon Martin case didn't get the kind of press in the United Kingdom that it did in Canada or the United States. My friends have been overwhelmingly supportive. I've received a lot of voices from a lot of white people saying that what I wrote really spoke to them, that they didn't understand a lot of the everyday experiences of racism. And that has been really, really personally meaningful for me to hear people say that what I said has mattered and has opened their eyes even a little bit to some of what it means to be Black today.
Matthew Zimmermann Gomes, it's been a pleasure to have you on the air with us. We will link to your work on our site, steinershow.org, and thank you so much for taking your time with our listeners today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by four remarkable women, poets. Come on, son, is what we're going to talk about. You'll find out in a minute. Don't go away.